Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Laura Serrant, Professor of Community and Public Health Nursing at Manchester Metropolitan University, explores the issue of health inequalities through the lens of race and intersectional identities in a seminar entitled From Silence to Speaking, On Silences, Health and the Importance of Being Heard. This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 17th of April 2019.
Thank you, and thank you all for taking the time to sit in here when it's much sunnier outside. And I understand from my sister, who used to live in East Kilbride, that the sun in Scotland is a relatively rare but welcome occurrence. So I thank you even more for taking time to be here today. I think when I was invited by Irma and by the GCPH to do this presentation, one of the things I reflected on was, okay, then what should I say? What is it that needs to be said or needs to be shared that would help and support not only the efforts of those people who are working to give voice to those who are silenced systematically, continuously, and historically, but what will it do to help the organization itself to think practically about what else do we need to do and how do we actually start or continue our work? And so I thought I'd focus this presentation on movement, moving from a point of being silenced or silent to a position where we can start to hear what people have to say, what people feel, and what people experience, and how that can impact on our decisions in policy, in politics, and in health and social care. So from silence to speaking. I think the first thing for me really is understanding what does it take to provide good care in health and in social care. I'm a nurse and I'm outing myself as such, always have been, and always will be. It's one of those for your whole life professions, I think. But when we think about care and welfare, what do we think about as public members of the public? Do we think about the old adage of the angel by the bedside, sitting in the wee small hours at people at their time of greatest need? Do we think about public health and education? How do we actually enable the next generation, our children, our grandchildren, and their children, to be in a better space for health than we are or that we have been? Or is it about how we're able to provide a uniformity of diverse care at the most important point of people's lives when they make that last and final journey from this place to another? Or is it what we do in terms of education? Is that where we put our efforts? Ensuring that the education of the next round of professionals in health, in care, in social care, actually is informed and informs the people that they aim to serve? How far do we educate our professionals to be able to be culturally safe, that is, in the 21st century, to give equal chance to the diversity of our populations? Or is it about the individual way, the small ways in which we help one person to understand themselves and their health better so that they can make informed choices for themselves? Or is it how we look after ourselves? There's no doubt that the greatest resource for any health or care system is the workforce and the people who work there. How do we ensure that we save the people who provide the care as much as the people who receive? All these things are areas that we have to embrace when we think about public health, when we think about health, and we think about welfare. And you might say, well, why have you started with that when you're talking predominantly around marginalized perspectives? And that's because the important aspect of professional practice is that we provide a range and scope of care that reaches the needs of everybody who is in our population. And at the point at which our services fail to reach some or all of our people, then it fails to achieve its objectives. I don't think there is a better definition of professional practice, whether you're looking at health or social care, than that named in the Wandless report from 2004. And for those of you who are not as old as me, you might have to go back a bit to find it. But I still think that this, for me, epitomizes why we do what we do. Because professional practice is about a science and an art. One cannot survive without the other. And it's the science and the art of promoting health, preventing illness. But the key thing for me in this definition is it is towards the end, where it talks about achieving this not through the magnificence of one profession or one clinical skill or one area of social form, but through the organized efforts of society and the organized efforts of private people, of organizations, of individuals and communities. That to me sums up what we aim to try and achieve through the actions, through the interactions, and through the working across boundaries of professions. I've not seen a better definition of what it is we're trying to do and we're trying to achieve. However, as I've said, in the 21st century, we are much more of a diverse population. Last year marked 70 years since the Windrush, the Empire Windrush appeared at Tilbury Docks, 70 years since the NHS, and 1 month after the NHS was launched. It's of no coincidence that that was the time when the Windrush appeared, where people came. Large majorities of health and care workers, nurses, doctors, professionals in their own communities came literally because in the wonderful place the NHS was, we didn't have enough people to actually staff it. And so from its inception, 70 years plus, diversity and health have been combined together. This quote here from Kona, who's a midwife, talks about the importance of diversity in health and how it's in our everyday experience. There is nothing that we do around health, public health, well-being, social care, that doesn't mean working across diversity, across difference and with difference. And being able to manage that and work with that is a key aspect of our work. However, as she says, most of the time, it's a thing that we spend least time thinking about. It's often neglected. Many of our gold standard pathways, our clinical trials, our tests of competence and confidence actually fail to reflect the diversity of the patients, the communities, the people, the individuals that we hope for it to work for. If we look at the detail of some of the samples, the participants in the studies that we use to underpin our policies, how much of that reflects the population we actually see around us in the everyday? Very little, usually. In fact, in a good study, in my experience, it's often written as one of the limitations. And for limitations, read, to be looked at later. So how does it feel when you are a member of a marginalized group who doesn't appear in that data, in that evidence? How does it feel when at the same time you may be either in receipt of that care or you may be, as myself, a professional trying to train, to understand, to provide that care? And how does it feel when you're not a member of a marginalized group, but you have an internal drive to try to give people equal chance, and you don't necessarily have the information, the evidence, the programs, the guidance to enable you to enact that? For me, I think that it feels like being a bit of an insider out. An insider in a sense that you know what's needed to be done, or you have a sense that something's not right, but an outsider in that it doesn't really fit with what it is you're asked to do, you're able to do, or what you receive if you're on the other end. I like this picture because it's quite difficult to tell who's inside the cell and who's out. What's important here, though, is that in that space where people can't find answers or facilities or services that suit their needs, somebody's in jail. Somebody is behind bars and unable to act. And somebody else often is outside, sometimes unable and hopefully not unwilling to let them out. The moral argument about diversity and about enabling people in ways that they need and would help them most is quite easy to make. But it still leaves the question of, well, how hard can it be? If we're all convinced, at least theoretically, why is it so difficult? It's often difficult because we are constrained by the tensions that existed before us. We're constrained by things at an individual level or socially or as a group in society. What it's okay to say or not say, whether we have the words to say what we need to say, and whether we feel we have the evidence or the knowledge to back up what it is we feel inside. It's difficult then, in that scenario, to actually enact or plan actively to address needs around diversity. And they are complicated by our histories. They're complicated by everything from Windrush. And if you don't believe me, remember the scandal of last year. They're complicated by what was in the past, but they're also complicated by our political balance and politics around resources. The politics of resource is usually what happens and what we see in the people and the communities we work with. The decisions made in policy are enacted in the everyday in front of us. They walk through our doors in our clinics, in our communities. They walk through our doors in our homes and our houses, the consequences of inequality and disparity. And so sometimes in that messy place between an internal drive and a lack of external agency, our actions are often sanitized or avoided by focusing on the need for the right policy and the right documentation, because that we can control. And in a sense, we feel that at least we start to do something. And that's why we end up where we are now, in terms of thinking, what can I do and how do I do it? So I thought I would actually share with you a bit of my personal views of, okay, who would I say, or what examples would I give of people who I think have attempted or succeeded in doing these things well? And in thinking about this, I'm reminded of the words of Jan Fishan Khan, who, if you have not heard of him, was a 17th century philosopher. He was initially actually a Sikh warrior before he became a philosopher. There's a bit of history for you. And in Envisioning Leadership, what I think about is his words where he talks about purpose of action. And he coined the phrase, the candle is not there to illuminate itself. And for me, that really means about what we do as in leadership, what we do in agency, what we do as enactors around these agendas. That in doing our work, even with all the messiness of the inside, the outside, the lack of evidence, the internal drive, and what do we do next, in doing the work, even without the result at the end, we actually make a change. Because we raise the ability and we give opportunity for people to be heard. And that is something that is always missing or often missing in the first instance. So let me share with you two people who I think do this really well or have done this really well. And some of you may or may not know these people. They're both women. I'm going to tell you the beginning so that you're aware. The first one is Fannie Lou Hamer. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of Fannie Lou Hamer. She was a civil rights activist in the American civil rights movement. And Fannie Lou Hamer was a woman who was born with mild learning difficulties. She also had physical disability, and yet she marched, she moved. And she also challenged internally in the civil rights movement as well as externally. She challenged for the recognition of her own diversity within the group that she was in. And she stood and she spoke at many, many congresses. And even if you'd not heard of Fannie Lou Hamer, if you've ever heard the words, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired," they are the words of Fannie Lou Hamer. And Fannie Lou Hamer, for me, epitomizes envisioning leadership around racialized, around diversity, and around inclusion, because she epitomized the importance of being able to feel that you can be heard, that you can stand. She also epitomized for me the importance of recognizing the diversity within marginalized groups and not pushing everybody together as if we were a unified whole, but seeing the individual within the group and the diversity as well as the group itself. The second person you may know is a very close friend of mine. That's Dame Professor Elizabeth Anionwu. Elizabeth Anionwu was my first mentor. Elizabeth Anionwu was the reason why we have sickle cell and thalassemia as a recognized service within the United Kingdom. She was the first sickle cell and thalassemia specialist nurse ever. And she was also the woman who spearheaded the campaign for a statue of Mary Seacole in London. That's the picture in the middle, for those of you who can see it. The statue of Mary Seacole, which we all took part in raising the money for, took almost 10 years to get enough money, 12 years for the statue to appear, based on £1 donations for badges and a few charity donations. If any of you go to London, the statue stands outside Guy's and St. Thomas's and it looks across at Westminster, the very place where she appeared on more than one occasion to ask for permission to join the nurses at the Crimea alongside Florence Nightingale. And because of issues of race and gender at the time, was refused to go. But she saved her money and she went anyway. She wasn't allowed to work in Scutari at the hospital, but she worked actually on the battlefields, caring for the sick, the dying, and the wounded during the war. And she was honored by the military themselves. Interestingly, when she came back to England, she came back almost to a hero's welcome by the military, who actually hoped that England would not forget one who had served her soldiers so well. Race and gender of the time meant she died in a pauper's grave. But interestingly, her statue is the only one in the city of London of a woman who's not a monarch. Her statue is the only one in the city of London of a woman who is black. And she's facing Westminster for eternity. So, these two women, why have I identified them? And I think what they epitomize for us is the importance of compassionate leadership. Compassionate leadership which actually recognizes the equality of voices and the importance of using people's experiences in order to start and think about policy or practice changes. And there are five things that are key principles here. And here are the first four. The first one is recognizing that health is a positive resource and a lifelong process, which in public health we recognize, we understand, that we never actually have done health. It changes with us, and it changes with communities, and it changes over time. And that importantly, the public, carers, communities are key parts of what we do. It's really nice for me to speak to public health interested people. When I do this presentation and people are hospital-based, sometimes it takes a bit of persuading. But it's good to be in this situation. The importance of the intra and interdisciplinary approach. No one profession, no one area of practice, no one group, whether voluntary, statutory, or any other, can do it in isolation. And only by that can we make sure that our efforts attain a sustained and accountable improvement in practice, in policy, in education and research. We need all four of those things. There's no point just being really good at the practice and ignoring the rest, or really good at the education and ignoring the rest. And sometimes what we do is we take turns in deciding which of those four things is most important. The science and the art of care requires all those four things equally. But unless they are based around the voices and experiences of people we don't usually hear from, we end up with what we've always got: gold standards which don't account for the communities that we're then going to try to make them work in. Now you might say, well, there's four things there, and I said there was five. The fifth thing for me is memory. We've all been here before. And in the words of George Santana, those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And anyone here who works in health or social care will go, well, I remember that from last time. I would hazard that sometimes we're condemned to repeat things that we don't learn from. So I thought maybe a little tiny history lesson may be called for. We need to remember that care, healthcare, support did not start in the sanitized places that we have as hospitals, as clinics, as community agencies. It started in the squalor and in the places where people died regularly and often. It started in Victorian England around the streets. Places where if you died in the night, your body remained there until the morning, until somebody came around and said, bring out your dead. Places where children were lucky to live beyond the first year. Places in which people didn't have enough to eat and were lucky if they had a sound place to live and weren't being killed by the very house in which they lived due to poor sanitation, etc. I could also, I suppose, in parts, certainly of Scotland and England and the world, say exactly the same for now. History is repeating itself while we sit here. We've not learned from that past, and it comes around. We're in a position where many people arrive at the countries, arrive in places through economic loss, arrive in places for many, many reasons, and face the same challenges. We are in a place where many people born and raised in this country, because of the inequalities they face, equally have less to eat and worry that their houses are not going to kill them. Inequality around race and the intersectional aspects with that used to be a lot more overt. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. We see now, and we've seen recently, the rise of very similar stories, very similar experiences to what we thought were long gone. And we need to face that and centralize that in part of our thinking about how we include the whole of our population when we plan for health and care. But not to be blinded to the fact that sometimes in healthcare and in social care, the subtleties, the minor aggressions that wear us away are still there too. If we do not remember the past, it will come back constantly, not only to haunt us, but to ensure that some of our population have less chance. In Glasgow, like anywhere else, there are areas where the difference in life expectancy can be 10, 11 years or more. It's important to remember that when we talk about racialized identities and minorities and marginalization, these are not in isolation to the other things that impact on people: poverty, lack of opportunity. All these things intersect to create the disparities that we have. So inequalities don't just exist in a hierarchy of top to bottom. They include are included in a range. So people within the same social groups, the same areas, have quite diverse experiences because of the particular differences in their identities, in their opportunities. To some extent, we've always known this in public health. I'm not going to point out any particular person for a particular decade, but I'm sure you can all look at this slide and think of something you remember happening in your lifetime, in your childhood. Public health has always been a changing health concept to address issues of inequality. So far from the 20s right through to the 2010s, we focused on the external, the structural, the medical, the locational. The challenge for us now as we move towards the 2020s next year is the issues of identity and belonging and how they impact on people's health and life chances and intersect with these things. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. It's easy sometimes to think about these things in a kind of moral, abstract, academic, policy-related way. But ultimately, the personal is political. What happens to each of us on an individual level and all the people we know is the policy and the political point, where the political point is about distribution of resources. It's about addressing the unwarranted variation in outcomes, in experiences, and in resource distribution. What I've learned so far in my almost 37 years since I qualified as a nurse is that actually it's down to how we respond to the needs of communities and what we learn. And actually the personal, what happens personally and what happens professionally, are so closely bound that it's quite difficult for us to separate them. So what I wanted to do was actually to remind us ourselves of some of the personal things that's happened to me, to remind myself, because it's good to remember those things, because they actually drive me forward in my work and come with me when I sit at tables to discuss academic thoughts, research outputs, and policy decision making. Because they're the same things that sit with each individual person and each member of the community when they ask us for our help and our support and our direction. Our decisions and our reactions ultimately affect the communities in which we live and the society. When I finished my PhD in 2004, after all that work, blood, sweat and tears, excessive amounts of coffee, crying, ugly crying many times, I came up with this concept of screaming silences, which unites the personal and the professional parts of my identity and my work. And screaming silence is the concept that underpins the silences framework that you were highlighted to earlier. And screaming silences reflects experiences which are historically and or politically undervalued, absent, or invisible. The seldom heard experience. And what happens is that we create gold standards, policies, procedures in the absence of that evidence. And that means that we create those policies and practice in silence. So I want to share a couple of silences about my own experience for you. As I've already said, I was a nurse. I am a nurse. I lead a nursing department now. And my experience of nurse training was very much insider out. And what did I mean by that? What they call transcultural nursing, which I call culturally safe, is problematic. I was the only black student nurse in a class of 30. I was the first black student nurse they'd had on the program. And while we did a lot of training and clinical learning about the body, about reactions, about signs and symptoms, in every situation, none of the people looked like me. While we talked about transcultural nursing, working across cultures and communities, in every situation, the patient was from a minority group and the nurse wasn't. So what did that mean for me? The opportunity for learning about how to be culturally safe, and by that I mean be able to provide confident and competent in your ability to provide care for everybody that you meet, irrespective of their skin color, their race, their religion, their belief, or their situation, is problematic because it really, really only depended on whether the tutor was interested in that, whether it came up at all. And the same thing happened in practice. On a good day, as a student nurse working in Sheffield, is we had those old Nightingale wards, you know, the ones with the beds all in a row. At least maybe a few times a week, a patient would refuse for me to care for them. I don't want that black nurse because her hands are not clean. I don't want that black nurse, I want a proper nurse. On a good day, the sister or the charge nurse in charge would come up with me to the patient and say, this nurse is perfectly competent, I will stay with you, Laura, while you do whatever you're doing and I will support you, you will be fine. On a bad day, the same nurse or charge nurse might just say, don't worry, Laura, just go to somebody else. On my worst day, I went down 7 beds before a patient would allow me to feed them. The personal is political. And that's no different to the experiences of people when they go for services. I was a professional in that situation. And yet, the safeguarding for the workforce was absent in many cases. So this is a matter of life, of safety and well-being. As a mother, my first son was born. He's nearly 30 now. My first son was born, and this is a picture of a child with Mongolian blue spot. For those of you who can spot it, I don't know if you can see it with the light on the screen, but you can see slightly dark patches on the back of the child here. For those of you who know, Mongolian blue spot, as it's called, is quite common, very common in children with dark skins. But it does appear to look like a bruise. After I had 3 different midwives and helpers just come to my house and asked to just check my son over, what I noticed was, I thought, they think it's not accidental injury. Here's a black woman in a house on her own with a child that appears to have bruises down its back. Now, I don't blame those nurses, because they were doing their job, because if it had been, they were doing exactly what they should do. What I raise the fact is that when we talk about if they had actually been trained to be culturally safe, they would have not been put in that position, and neither would I. Interestingly, because obviously I was a nurse myself, I clicked on quite quickly what the problem was. Imagine if I was a young single mother on her own, not very knowledgeable, or someone who was very in awe of people coming to their house, of professionals. It could have been a whole different story. So these are not just issues of moral right or wrong. These are issues of life, of safety, and of well-being. If we don't remember those things, we are condemned to repeat them. Some of you, or hopefully many of you, will be aware of the work of Roger Klein and Michael West around diversity within health professions, and particularly in the NHS. I don't know if you probably can see this very well, but he talks about, Michael West and Roger Klein's works, talks about the snowy white peaks of the NHS, how the higher in which you climb, the whiter the peak becomes. And beneath that context is information, evidence-based information, which shows us that the attitude of diversity displayed by many in the senior echelons of the NHS particularly seemed to be a mixture of indifference and denial. The personal is political. And that the research done by Michael West and his team suggests that actually this is more than just a moral argument. This is a business decision. Because in areas where the black and minority ethnic NHS staff are treated well and report good working relationships, the climate of respect for everybody, for patients, for service users, for everyone in the team is higher. And that increases the satisfaction with services in health and care. There are some silent issues, some things that are not usually spoken about in the idea of safeguarding ourselves. And I say ourselves because for me it's an insider-outsider situation. I do not have the luxury of turning up at a policy meeting and no longer being black. I do not have the luxury of turning up a policy meeting and no longer coming from a relatively poor inner city background. That comes with me wherever I go. It even went with me to the palace. But there are some silent things in sometimes our policies and procedures that we don't always see, particularly around NHS care, which I'm highlighting because that's my area of expertise. But I'm sure and I know it to be similar in social work, in social care, and in many, many places. The idea that support is openly available to all people at the point of need, but we defined who is inside and outside of that. And that there is a right to support and that is enabled through open communication, and yet there are some things that we cannot say or we do not speak about. That there is a 24-hour access to help, but for whom and at what cost? The intersectional aspects of our nature mean that which communities use your services more, which communities are able to access, but we provide for everybody. But if it costs £10 for me to get there, and the choice is between eating and paying £10 to go to see you, which one am I going to do? And the freedom to speak out is always there. But the freedom to be heard and the confidence that if you speak out, you will be listened to is not always there. And when that comes with a historical experience of what happens when you speak out, it builds within it a fear of discovery, a fear of suspicion, and suspicion around centralized services, which have never listened to you anyway. And certainly in their books, in their pamphlets, in their gold standard pathways, do not include anyone who looks, feels, or experiences the way you do. So when we think about support from an insider perspective, it's quite difficult sometimes to work out whether we are begging or we're seeking support. Are we waiting for a handout? Are you going to stop today to listen? Or are you going to walk on by because it's too busy, it's too difficult? A lot of people talk to me about why I do what I do and how I carry on doing it. And many people say that. We've all had it at different points, I think, in public health when we work around inequalities and disparities on many, many platforms. So I wanted to talk a little bit about resilience, because that's usually what people talk about. What you need to be is resilient. People have said to me the reason I survived and thrived after my training was my resilience. But often when we present resilience, we present it like this: juggling plates, your heart beating fast, being squeezed on every side, or sometimes being in a pit somewhere in despair. That is the way we often talk about resilience, and building resilience, we talk about helping people out of those spaces. But I kind of want to present as well another view of resilience, because while we may be marginalized, while I may be silenced, when I was younger, it's a bit harder to silence me now, I wasn't always being worn down. Because there's another part of resilience, a different kind of weathering those experiences gave me, which built my resilience in this way, where the resilience and the weathering was about wearing away or changing the appearance and texture of something by long exposure to the atmosphere. This is a picture of Durdle Door, for those of you who don't know it, down in Devon. I took this picture. I love this as a picture of weathering, the type of weathering that changes you, but changes you into something bigger and stronger, but different. So when I carry and share my experiences with you, it's not to make you feel sorry for me. It's not to wear me down, but it's to claim and own that as something that I use actively to move on and move through and to support, to lift as I climb. So resilience for me is about three things, and I think it's summed up really well here in the quote by Diane Kuto. She said, resilient people have got three characteristics, and for me it is about personal and professional resilience. A staunch acceptance of reality, a belief that life is meaningful, and here's the one which I think most people in health and care do very well, and certainly people do in voluntary and support agencies, an uncanny ability to improvise. One of the things, one of the strengths of my weathering and the weathering of my community and many communities, many diverse communities, is the ability to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, to find something positive in what we do and move forward with it. So inclusion isn't about doing favours. It's about harnessing all the resources and the strengths that are available within a community in order to find the right solutions for everybody. So, the 12th century theologian, John of Salisbury, used the phrase from the Bishop of Sartres about standing on the shoulders of giants, which I've had to challenge my son to say it's not just the Oasis album. And actually, the phrase actually focuses on that built resilience that's built through communities or with communities. The idea that we see better, we see further because of the work of those who came before us. Here I've listed for you, just for my interest and for your interest if you don't know them, a list of some of the giants on whose shoulders I stand. They're all nurses. They're very diverse. They are all women, but they're a very diverse group of women. Some are alive, some are dead. But they're all real people who actually actioned that need to engage with racialized minority identities in their work. They're not all minorities themselves, but they've used actively their positions to advance and give people better chances. So there's a few questions I want to move to as we come towards the end. What do you ask yourself as an organization or a group if you want to work on this agenda? And here are some of the questions. What do you want your organizational contribution to stand for? These are the things you need to think about. What kind of impact as an organization do you want to have on patients, on families, on communities? What contributions do you want to make as an individual or a group to the professional field? And whose lives will you have touched by the time you finish what you're doing? And what lessons do you want to pass on to future generations, whether they're generations of professionals, of communities, families, or individuals? And how best can you contribute to giving people an equal chance of health and life? And the challenge is always what's stopping you. I asked this question to Gina Miller, those of you who know who Gina Miller is, when I was at the Power List in 2018. And I asked, she was asked about why she did what she did around Article 50. I'm not going to mention the B word. And she said, I do what I do because I'm fearful, not fearless. And I think that's a really good thing for us to remember as we work in public health. As we try to increase the diversity, the racialization, the marginalization aspects of our work, we're going to be afraid. But we need to do it because we are fearful of what happens if we do not face and we do not engage. And that's about making sure that we have diversity in and for our practice areas. It's more than just colour status. What I hope you've remembered from what I've said today is that it's intersectionally linked with everything that we are as individuals, as professionals, as communities. We are not, any of us, one definition of ourselves. And it actually requires safeguarding our communities and ourselves for all our sakes. Equal emphasis on the needs of a workforce as well as the people that depend on them for support. And we need action to safeguard ourselves and our professions to do that. So, what's your pledge from this point? What do you not know yet that you need to know? What do you need to find out to enable you to move forward on this? And where will you go next? And finally, I want to leave you with a quote from Audre Lorde. I'm glad Irma mentioned about the BBC. She was the woman that I spoke about on the BBC programme on the news. I like a bit of Audre. And she talks to me about the importance of diversity. She's talking about her experiences when she was in her treatment for breast cancer, which unfortunately finally took her life. And she talks about the importance of the inclusive support that she gets. And she said, "The women who sustained me through that period were black and white, old and young, lesbian, bisexual, and heterosexual. And we all shared a war against the tyrannies of silence. They all gave me a strength and a concern without which I could not have survived intact. Within those weeks of acute fear came the knowledge. Within the war that we are all waging with the forces of death, subtle and otherwise, conscious or not, I am not only a casualty, I am also a warrior. What are the words that you do not have yet? What do you need to say? Perhaps for some of you here today, I am the face of one of your fears. Because I am a woman, because I am black, because I am myself a black woman warrior poet doing my work, come to ask you, are you doing yours? Thank you for your time."
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you would like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.